In the following series, I'm going to focus on the Israel-Gaza conflict. I'm going to try and tackle some tough questions that will include, what is the American interest in this war? What values are we trying to promote? Is the U.S. a force for good? And what really happened on October the 7th? What was the history that got us here? And is oppression what really motivates Hamas, or is it something else? Is Israel's motive colonization? And is Israel an apartheid nation? How do you fight a proportional war? And what are the longer-term prospects for peace and a two-state solution? I'm Paul Johnson. I'm just a typical optimistic American who believes that the U.S. is a cause for good in the world. If you're interested in this discussion, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, and let's get started.
Destiny. Destiny. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. And I have a rendezvous with destiny.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
Now, this is a geopolitical analysis about the role that the U.S. plays in the Israel-Gaza conflict. Before you invest an hour, it's important to disclose my bias. When it comes to the Middle East, everybody has a bias, and I certainly have mine. I have visited and studied most of the major genocide sites in the world, including Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, as well as the Holocaust sites. I recently returned from Israel meeting with experts on both sides of the October 7th conflict, as well as national security leaders from both the U.S. and Israel. Over time, though, I've been a pretty steady supporter of Israel. A couple of other disclosures. First, I don't have any justification for a parent having to pull their two-year-old out of a heap of rubble. People who see those images on TV and they're appalled, well, that's exactly how you should feel. We should all be appalled. I have to say this, that I have studied war. I've been in numerous places immediately in the aftermath of war. Look, war is a bad thing. I don't have a good example of war. I also see a large distinction between Muslims and jihadists. I recently came back from a trip to Bosnia, where the Serbian government years ago, backed by Russians, after the fall of Tito, engaged in a genocide against the Muslim people in Bosnia. In many ways, those Muslims in Bosnia remind me of the people of Israel. They're industrious. Even after all they've experienced, they don't see themselves as victims. They're trying to rebuild after all the suffering, after suffering an incredible brutality. But they see themselves as survivors and not as victims. I've also had discussions with both Gaznians and Serbians. At least as it relates to the massive murder of people that their countries both engaged in, there are strong similarities between both. Both want to deny the atrocities that their government was engaged in. Both see themselves as victims. And while they say it's about land, it's really about objectifying the other race. Now, that concept isn't limited to being a Muslim thing. I see signs that say Free Gaza. The polling of Gazans are pretty clear on this point. Gaza isn't looking to be free. This isn't about a two-state solution to them. It's about a belief in a religious destiny to restore a single Muslim state to all of Palestine, as they say, from the river to the sea. With as many times as I've been in the Middle East, I wanted to believe that Hamas was an anomaly, a small set of Gazans, not really representative of the Gazan people, just a small group of people who were a terrorist organization. I thought about them like the 19 terrorists who hijacked the four airplanes on 9/11. Unfortunately, all that just proves to be untrue. I'm not saying that there are not innocent people in Gaza. However, the people of Gaza voted for Hamas in 2005. And while they won that election with a full understanding that Hamas was a jihadist organization, Hamas is not only the government in Gaza, it is still highly supported by the people of Gaza. The army that massacred on October the 7th was 4,000 young Gaza men, highly trained, in uniform, and in part of a larger army of 30,000 men. Now consider this. Gazans support, according to polling, Hamas by 40%. But even more shockingly, They support the actions of October the 7th by 80%. You know, we struggle to understand the basic mindset of jihadism in America. In a civilized society, especially in Western liberal democracy, we value prosperity. You can hear from people in civilized societies comments like, well, everyone just wants the same thing. They want a job and they want to feed their family and to protect their children. You can see on so many videos done on this show in conversations with Dr. Bashaw and our book Addictive Ideologies that when one is radicalized, they're focused on politics or religious values far outweighs prosperity. In Gaza, for the 80% who support the atrocities of October the 7th, it's just not about economics. It's not about prosperity. And it's not about humanity or civility. It's about indoctrination. Psychologically, the support or justification of October the 7th comes from a disturbed mindset or a radical ideology that puts religious and political values high enough that it justifies the elimination of an entire population. The political goals are higher than prosperity, higher than even the safety of their own families. Now think about this for a moment. Osama bin Laden and 9/11. You know, he came from one of the wealthiest families in Saudi Arabia. He cared nothing about prosperity. He was typical of a jihadist mindset, the same mindset that flew planes into the Twin Towers. Shockingly, the overwhelmingly amount of victims from jihadists are Muslims. To a jihadist, killing Muslims is justified in that if they were true Muslims, they'll just go to paradise anyway. This is legions away from our own thinking. This is not the mindset of Americans, and it is not the mindset of Israelis. Logic tells us that if Israel wanted to eliminate Gaza, that they could. It's not the mindset of the overwhelming majority of Muslims. You know, I have a lot of Muslim friends throughout the world, and I know that this radical mindset does not control the majority of the 2 billion people who are Muslims. But I also know enough about politics to understand the incredible power of cognitive dissonance, and it causes people to support the social tribe that they belong to, even when they're conflicted morally. Now, that's true for more than just Muslims. Cognitive dissonance and tribalism is a dangerous thing, and we should think about that problem right here at home with partisanship. Now, my last disclosure is I'm an independent. I'm worried about the extremes in both parties in the United States, and I don't buy into the idea that anti-Semitism is a problem of one party or one side. I see it as a problem of extremes on both sides.
Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace us! Jews will not replace us!
I watched the far right march in Charlottesville with torches saying, Jews will not replace us. But I was also stunned by comments on college campuses around the world where professors said that they were exhilarated by October the 7th. In some campuses, they chanted from the river to the sea, the opposite of a two-state solution. And even in Australia, some were chanting gas to Jews. Now, while I don't believe that most of the young people who are appalled by the bombing in Gaza are racist, I believe that the things that many of them are saying are racist. More importantly, I believe that they're unwittingly being fed a steady diet of an ideology that is a very racist at its core. But wittingly or unwittingly, taking the side of Hamas is taking the side of a group of people who would actually commit genocide. Allowing no room to consider Israel's right to defend itself after the atrocities of October the 7th, based on tropes like Israel is committing a genocide or Israel is an apartheid nation, is parallel to the America First movement in the United States during World War II, supporting Germany and Adolf Hitler and blaming the Jews for the world's problems. And wittingly or unwittingly, we don't look back very kindly on those people who supported Adolf Hitler. I can tell you that history won't look back well on those who supported Hamas. So here's the thing. If you believe that the U.S. is somehow controlled by a powerful group of elite people guiding us aimlessly to intervene on Israel's side, or if you believe that every situation is defined by those who are the oppressors and those who are the victim, then I'm just going to give you a reason to save yourself some time. If what I've said so far upsets you, there's no need to watch the rest and be outraged. Look, all of us have a bias. In fact, I believe if you don't believe you have a bias, that's actually reason for you to get some therapy. My hope is to give you a framework to think about these issues. The Middle East is fraught with complexity, and you can't get it on a 30-second news clip or on a TikTok post. So, if I haven't offended everybody yet, if there's anyone left, well, let's start. What I'd like to start with is a short segment on values. In any alliance, the alignment of values and interest between nations is crucial. However, wars are not fought over values. They're fought over interests. Only few deep, misleading people doubt the U.S. has more in line with Israel on values than with Hamas. But let's talk about those values just for a few moments. Hamas, following their election in 2005, implemented a very radical form of Sharia law based on a jihadist mindset. The laws demonstrated opposition to equal rights for women, 10-year prison terms for people based on sexual orientation, and they suspended future elections. In contrast, Israel upholds the principles of human rights, including equality and civil liberties, and they maintain a robust democratic election process. Now, Israel isn't perfect, and neither are we. However, we're committed to work towards those ideals. Our balance of power, the rule of law, the election process, and a belief in democratic principles are designed towards that greater aim. Now, you have undoubtedly heard the claim that Israel is an apartheid state, that it is engaged in a genocide against Palestinians. The definition of an apartheid state is one that's based on a policy of political, social, and economic discrimination based on race. Yet inside of Israel proper lives about 1.7 million Muslims that possess the same rights as their Jewish counterparts. They have voting rights, equal rights, civil liberties, and they even have representation in the Knesset through political parties. This seems to be pretty compelling evidence that they don't discriminate against Muslims purely based on race. Now, that's not to deny that there's a conflict between Israel and Palestine in Gaza and in the West Bank. But maybe it's based on something other than wholesale discrimination against Muslims. What this conflict is based on is a difficult question that we're going to try to deal with as we go deeper. To most Americans, it's evident that the values of Israel and the United States are more closely aligned, that both are democracies that value civil rights and equal rights and human rights. Inarguably, they both support the rights of their citizens regardless of sex, sexual orientation, or religion. This is just not true in Gaza. However, nations do not engage in conflict solely due to shared values. It's a nation's interest that dictates such decisions to take part in war. The United States has been a long-standing supporter of Israel, but this support hasn't been unwavering in every conflict. Even when Israel faced existential threats. A recent film called Golda Meir illustrates instances where the U.S. refrained from supporting Israel in certain conflicts. Today, the landscape's changed, and there exists a strategic interest for the United States to be involved in this region. And that is where we'll begin our discussion, examining the strategic interests of the United States in this complex scenario. Since the conclusion of World War II in 1947, the United States has played a pivotal role in shaping the global order, anchoring it around American ideals. At that juncture, the U.S. emerged relatively unscathed in terms of infrastructure, and it stood as the only nation with a robust functioning economy that was capable of international trade. We levered this economic strength, and we embarked upon a mission to reconstruct the war-ravaged world. Now, this was epitomized by the Marshall Plan, through which billions of dollars were generously distributed. Additionally, the U.S. extended substantial loans and opened its market to foreign goods. However, this aid came with a significant expectation, a quid pro quo, and that is that nations had to choose between democratic values championed by the West and the authoritarianism of the Soviet Union. The American-led order resulted in unprecedented global progress. Human development accelerated at a pace never seen before, evidenced by leaps in global literacy rates, dramatic improvements in child mortality, and as noted by the United Nations, a substantial reduction in worldwide poverty. During World War II, the Axis powers, driven by a much grimmer view of humanity, pushed the world towards darkness. The fascist regimes of Germany and Italy and Japan at one point appeared poised to dominate. Had they succeeded, our world today would be vastly different and much bleaker. A similar existential threat emerged with the Soviet Union. But fortunately, this confrontation remained a cold war rather than escalating into a full-scale conflict. The efforts of leaders like John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan were instrumental in navigating those treacherous waters without veering into a catastrophic conflict. Ultimately, it was the values of the United States that prevailed. Now we find ourselves at the precipice of another significant threat to this world order, one that could be as menacing as the Axis powers or the Soviet Union. This new axis of authoritarians, comprising of China, Russia, and Iran, share a commonality in their authoritarian nature. Despite their differences, they view Western liberal democracies as threats, not just because of the higher quality of life these democracies offer, but also due to the rules-based order, which could undermine imperialistic ambitions. The United States remains a pivotal force in the global balance of power, notably serving as a significant barrier to the ambitions of regional hegemony pursued by key nations. In Europe, Russia, under Vladimir Putin's leadership, seeks to extend its influence. Across Asia, China, guided by Xi Jinping, is aggressively expanding its reach, impacting nations such as Japan, Taiwan, and even extending its influence to Australia. Meanwhile, in the Middle East, Iran is striving for dominance. Now, these diverse geopolitical aspirations converge in a unique alliance among Putin, Xi Jinping, and Rouhani. Despite their differing agendas, these leaders find common ground in their collective efforts to counterbalance the U.S. influence and pressure. The strategic triad formed by China, Iran, and Russia represents a contentious relationship at best. China's problematic treatment of its Muslim population and the historic border tensions between Russia and China make one wonder what is the glue that holds all three of these together. This is only recognized by an understanding of their collective aim to challenge the prevailing global order led by the United States. Their goal is to erode the influence by the U.S., thereby expanding their own dominion within the respective spheres of their influence. The driving force of this partnership is that they want the U.S. to leave their collective spheres. In so doing, China, Russia, and Iran would be able to undermine the rules-based international order and recalibrate the global power dynamics in their favor. If they can control the levers of global power, it won't be long before no one is accountable to a rules-based order, and potentially, we too may become subordinate to them on buying and selling goods, the reserve currency, and the ability to support our allies. The cornerstone of the U.S. strategy in this geopolitical chess game is deterrence. The ideological and economic vulnerabilities of China and Russia are reminiscent of a systematic flaws that plagued the Soviet Union, and they underscore the uncertain ability of their models in the long term. Both nations operate on mercantilist principles. They rely heavily on exploiting trade and relationships to their advantage, potentially resorting to imperialistic measures in the face of economic failure. Now, President Biden with Iran appears reluctant to invest America deeper into the Middle East. This is certainly driven by the American public's reluctance to engage in further Middle Eastern conflicts. The experience in Afghanistan and Iraq presents evidence of challenges inherent to such ventures. However, avoiding further entanglement is going to require a nuanced strategy that's far beyond isolationism or allowing the unchecked powers of groups like Hamas and Gaza. Only a robust deterrence strategy towards Iran and China and Russia will actually prevent us from being drawn into greater commitments. We often look at the arms race as one of the unfortunate consequences of the Cold War. However, the arms race and the policy of containment not only resulted in the Soviet Union collapse, but most historians agree it avoided a nuclear catastrophe. History is just clear on this one. A strong defense is the only safeguard against larger conflicts and the unthinkable. The emergence of a global order underpinned by American principles has ushered in an era of prosperity that is unparalleled in the annals of history. The adoption of fundamental rights such as civil rights, human rights, property rights, alongside the principles of free market economics and democratic elections, have yielded special benefits for humanity. Now, these ideals face challenges from a wide variety of different quarters. Authoritarian regimes, notably those of China and Russia, they pose a considerable threat to these values. They seek to undermine the foundations upon which global peace and prosperity were built. Moreover, entities like Iran and groups adhering to extremist ideologies, including Hamas, they propagate a worldview that is fundamentally a contradiction to all of those principles. Such forces not only erode basic human rights, but they've also been implicated in heinous acts against vulnerable populations, as tragically evidenced by the October 7th massacre. Nations like Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan stand at a critical juncture, representing pivotal battlegrounds in the defense and preservation of these universal values. You know, the foresight of Thomas Paine, asserting that the cause of the United States represents the broader cause of humanity, rings ever true, that the cause of America is in fact the cause of mankind. The ongoing struggle is not merely a defense of national interests, but it is a fight for the advancement and protection of human dignity across the globe. Iran, deeply rooted in its Persian heritage, stands distinct from its Arab nations in both cultural and political identity. As a predominantly Shia Muslim state, Iran's religious orientation contrasts with the Sunni majority prevalent in Arab nations. Nevertheless, Iran harbors ambitions to expand its influence throughout the Middle East, primarily by focusing on Shia communities. Unlike supporting a pan-Arab movement, which aims for unification under an Arab cultural and national identity, Iran's objectives are more inclined towards promulgating its own political and religious doctrines rather than promoting Arab unity. Now, the driving force behind Iran's aspiration to become a regional hegemony are multifaceted, and they encompass both religious motivations and a desire to revive Persian dominance. The historical Sunni-Shia divide, a schism stemming from the dispute over the rightful successor to the Prophet Muhammad following his demise in 1632, plays a significant role. Shia Muslims believe that Ali, the Prophet's cousin and son-in-law, was the legitimate heir, a belief that contradicts the Sunni perspective, which recognizes the first four caliphs as Muhammad's rightful successors. Shias revere Ali and the subsequent line of imams, believed to possess not only the rightful leadership, but also spiritual wisdom. The 12th imam, according to Shia belief, disappeared and is prophesied to return to restore justice. But these theological divides have huge consequences on the Middle East. The U.S.-Iran relationship soured significantly with the 1979 seizure of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, culminating in a 444-day crisis resolved by the 1981 Algiers Accord. This incident marked the beginning of the Islamic Republic's use of hostage-taking as a means to extract economic and political consequences. Iran's regional ambitions and threats have been consistent since the 1979 revolution, evidenced by Tehran and its proxy involvement in conflicts and insurgencies across Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. This reflects a fundamental principle of the Islamic Republic's ideology, and that is to propagate a vision of an Islamic order. Tehran's nuclear program, it serves a dual purpose, deterring regime change is one of them, and also enabling regional dominance through military strength. The fall of Saddam Hussein and Iran's strategic use of proxy militias further bolstered by its regional influence. Under the guidance of the late Qassem Soleimani, Iran crafted a sophisticated network of militias, enhancing its clout, particularly against those rivals like Saudi Arabia. Iran's military capability, bolstered by alliances with other authoritarian regimes, include the region's largest inventory of ballistic missiles. These missiles have been used against American interests and allies in the Middle East, including civilian targets in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, as well as American forces in Syria and Iraq. Additionally, Iran's aggressive actions in maritime domains, especially in the Persian Gulf, pose significant threats. Incidents involving attacks, harassments, and seizure of tankers are alarmingly frequent. Moreover, through Houthi presences in Yemen, Iran has extended its disruptive activities to the Red Sea, further destabilizing the regional security. So let's turn our attention to the Abraham Accords. During the Trump administration, Israel became keen on reshaping the Middle East geopolitical landscape, and it sought to realign Israel's regional relationships, effectively sidestepping the long-standing Palestinian issue. This approach hinged on the shared interest between Israel and Sunni-majority countries and Arab nations opposed to Iran's regional influence. Appropriately named the Abraham Accords, as both Jews and Arabs have all come from the same grandfather. Now, if you examine this map, we observe that Israel's pre-existing alliances with Egypt and Jordan. The Abraham Accord marks significant diplomatic achievements by fostering newfound ties between Israel and nations like the UAE, Morocco, and Bahrain. However, Saudi Arabia is the proverbial grand prize. It remains elusive to this framework. The question of why Saudi Arabia has not yet joined the Accords is subject to a whole bunch of interpretations. There are conservative commentators that speculate that President Joe Biden's reluctance to secure any accord with Saudi Arabia may stem from an unwillingness to acknowledge Trump's diplomatic success. While discerning the true motivation of this political figure is challenging, another plausible explanation revolves around Saudi Arabia's desire for security assurances that are akin to those offered by NATO, whereas an attack by a nation like Iran would elicit a robust military response from the allies. So the question is the U.S. ready to land Marines in the Middle East to protect further advances from Iran, or to give Saudi Arabia nuclear warheads if Iran becomes a nuclear power? Moreover, the significance of the Abraham Accords nomenclature warrants attention. It aptly reflects the shared Semitic lineage of Arabs and Jews as descendants of Abraham, symbolizing a potential bridge between these historically interconnected communities. There's a tendency to overlook the significance of the Abraham Accords in certain media circles, possibly due to their association with the president, President Trump, who many of them don't agree with. Now, personally, I don't align myself as a supporter of the former president. Yet I firmly believe that evaluating his actions and policies should transcend personal biases. Whether one views him favorably or not is not essential to assessing policies based upon their intrinsic merit rather than a lens colored by political allegiances. So, in light of this, I advocate for a more balanced and merit-based approach in evaluating political decisions and policies, irrespective of the administration from which they originate. Such an approach allows for more objectivity and a constructive assessment of their impact and value. Regarding Biden's alleged motivations in dealing with Saudi Arabia, I think that's debatable. I don't see that his motivation was geared towards Trump. I do see that there's a risk of commitment being requested of the U.S. by Saudi Arabia. Based on my experiences in the UAE and Morocco, these nations seem more amenable to forming alliances long ago. Perhaps they were viewed as low-hanging fruit. I just visited Morocco, and it stood out to me how they kept the historical Jewish synagogue in their downtown as a protective feature of the government. I also think it's doubtful the preemptive agreement with Saudi Arabia could have averted the October 7th events or impacted the trajectory of the Abraham Accords significantly. Wars and conflict are driven by national interest, and it would not have been in any Arab nation's interest to have helped out Israel with or without a treaty. But still, from a U.S. perspective, extending the Abraham Accords to include Saudi Arabia with appropriate security commitments, I think may be worth the trade-offs. Again, my bias is we are in a struggle between authoritarian axis and liberal democracy, and we have to use this as a gauge based upon who we support. Besides the fact that the Crown Prince has made reforms on human rights issues in Saudi Arabia, it's not lost on me that they're still authoritarian. But in the ideals of Henry Kissinger's balance of power theories, in this struggle, we need allies. Such a treaty between Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. could curtail Iran's aspiration for regional hegemony, aligning with the strategic interests of both the United States and our Middle Eastern allies. But the key is, what do we get for what it is that we're expected to deliver? The war in Israel threatens to expand to other parts of the Middle East. On Israel's northern frontier, tensions are escalating, yet the situation has not spiraled into a full-scale war. Despite this, the conflict has forced hundreds of thousands from both sides to flee their border cities. The future remains uncertain, and changes to the status quo are anticipated. Hezbollah, according to various estimates, possess over 130,000 missiles, potentially enabling them to launch more than 3,000 missiles at Israel for over a month. The restraint in deploying these missiles raises really some significant questions. And the obvious question is, why? Why hasn't Hezbollah been launching these missiles? A couple of concepts seem to stand out to me. Since October the 7th, Hezbollah has targeted Israel with drone attacks aimed at undermining Israel's sophisticated air defense systems, including radar and control towers. The strategy seems designed to weaken Israel's Iron Dome capabilities before initiating a missile offense. In response, Israel has conducted airstrikes against these drone threats. Technological advances have made sophisticated weaponry increasingly accessible and affordable. For instance, drone technology, once prohibitively expensive, is now widely available at minimal cost. This mirrors the evolution seen in consumer electronics, where features once costing tens of thousands of dollars are now standard in smartphones. The affordability of drones have been demonstrated in various conflicts, including in Ukraine and by such groups as Hezbollah and the Houthis, posing a challenge to a more expensive defensive system. The United States is actively developing technologies to counter these threats affordably. Innovations in monitoring and detections are progressing rapidly, with a focus on drone countermeasures. Promising developments include frequency jammers, GPS spoofers, high-powered microwaves, actually net guns, and hijacking cyber tools that are capable of redirecting drones. The anti-drone technology and laser systems are also being explored, offering a very low-cost, long-range solution that physically neutralizes drone threats without the need for physical ammunition. There are a lot of pros to this. It has long-range, low-cost-to-kill solution. It physically stops and destroys targeted drones to neutralize the threats quickly. It doesn't require physical ammunition. But there are some cons in that it's a large system. It's still fairly experimental, even though it's been deployed. And we also have to worry about what negative effects may come from it. Another factor possibly deterring Hezbollah from launching its arsenal is they're being directed from Iran not to. a full-scale assault by Lebanon could provide a significant Israel counteroffensive, potentially decimating Hezbollah's ground forces. Iran likely views Hezbollah's missile stockpile as a deterrent against Israel strikes on its nuclear facility, with Hezbollah acting as a strategic proxy. Furthermore, Iran's support for Hezbollah is part of a broader political strategy aimed at transforming Lebanon into a Shia Islamic Republic, influencing the Shia-Sunni divide and countering Saudi Arabia's regional dominance, particularly in the oil sector. This indicates that Iran's objectives extend beyond the immediate conflict with Israel, reflecting broader geopolitical ambitions. All in all, Iran has a much greater game plan in mind. Now, in late December, an Israeli drone precision strike in Beirut, Lebanon, targeted Saleh al-Arouri, the deputy political leader of Hamas, along with five other key figures. This operation unfolded in the heart of Hezbollah's stronghold, showcasing the complex geopolitical tapestry in the region, as Hezbollah stands as Iran's most influential proxy in the area. One might think about the rationale behind Hamas's commanders holding their meetings in Lebanon rather than being closer to Gaza's front line. Perhaps it's just a strategic twist in their playbook, or maybe, just maybe, they find that the allure of Beirut's renowned Hamas too irresistible to stay away. After all, when it comes to their objective, it seems that their sights are set on more than just the lands of Gaza. They're eyeing the whole menu. They want all of Israel. Al-Arouri, with a $5 million bounty from the U.S. State Department, was notably a wanted figure. He was indicted in 1985 on 15 charges, and he was implicated in the hijacking that led to the tragic murder of Robert Stethem, a U.S. soldier. The State Department highlighted Al-Arouri's role in furthering Palestinian Islamic Jihad activities, which spanned from five bombings and a murder to extortion and money laundering. This bounty was part of the department's Reward for Justice program, a significant initiative that has distributed over $150 million to more than 100 informants since its inception in 1984. They've caught a lot of bad guys. Now, on the following day, on January 3rd, tragedy struck again. Two suicide bombers targeted crowds in Iran, and they gathered to commemorate the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Qassem Soleimani, claiming nearly 100 lives. Soleimani, who is recognized as a strategic mastermind behind Iran's network of proxies, was succeeded by a leader who is perceived as less tactically astute. ISIS, in somewhat of a delayed response, claimed responsibility for the attack, contradicting earlier suggestions by the Revolutionary Guard commanders who pointed their fingers at Israel. Subsequently, the U.S. has carried out a strike in Baghdad, eliminating a senior commander of Iran-backed Iraqi militia. This act precipitated direct retaliation from Iran. The guards farmed their assault on Erbil as a reaction to recent Zionist regime atrocities and the elimination of their commanders. The term Zionist often is a point of contention. It fundamentally refers to the movement for the reestablishment of a Jewish state. However, it has become a loaded term globally, sometimes hijacked by anti-Semitic rhetoric to insinuate a far-reaching Jewish conspiracy, remnant of the infamous and discredited Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a book that helped start World War II. Iran's recent military maneuvers, including missile strikes against ISIS in Syria and an unprecedented attack in Pakistan targeting the Sunni militia group Jewish ul-Adil, I'm sure I messed that name up significantly, more than is a just retaliatory gesture for the Kerman suicide bombings. These strikes followed Pakistan's reciprocal missile strikes against separatists with Iran, unveiling a strategic recalibration rather than a complete overhaul of tactics. An Iranian official statement clarifies that this is a deliberate message to the U.S. and to Israel amidst the ongoing Gaza conflict. The official elucidates that, quote, by engaging targets in Pakistan and Erbil, Iran broadcasts a clear signal to Israel and American forces. Do not underestimate Iran and bring the Gaza conflict to an end. The stand reflects Iran's avoidance of a direct confrontation with Israel and the U.S., while at the same time striving to manifest its potential for formidable reprisals. On June 28, 2024, three U.S. Marines were killed in Jordan and over 40 were injured, according to drone may have been mistaken for an American aircraft returning to Tower 22, which is a base in the northeastern Jordan close to where the country's border converges with Syria and Iraq. Sabrina Sai, a Pentagon spokesperson, told reporters that the attack occurred early Sunday and struck living quarters, described as a containerized housing where personnel were still asleep in their bed. As of the writing of this, U.S. response to the attacks have hit over 85 sites of Iranian paramilitary groups. There is significant discussion around the concept that none of the strikes hit Iran, with the supporters for the Biden administration arguing that we would dramatically expand the American involvement through a war with Iran, and with Republican leadership arguing that unless you hit Iran directly, they'll respond to us as if we were weak. Now, my guess is that we're still way early in this process. We're not really sure about the totality of the American response. I'm going to be looking to see the strategic reasons for the targeted selection and to see if it was designed to protect the U.S. in the event that we have engaged more directly. The conflict in Yemen, which erupted in 2014, marked a significant escalation in the regional tensions when the Houthi movement, aligned with Shia interests and supported by Iran, overthrew the Sunni-dominated government and seized control of the capital. This upheaval prompted a coalition led by Saudi Arabia, supported by other Gulf states and backed by the United States, to launch airstrikes against the Houthi forces in early 2015. The proxy war that ensued has wreaked havoc on Yemen, an already impoverished nation, leading to a staggering death toll that are estimated somewhere close to 400,000 by the end of 2021. The United Nations has not hesitated to label this situation as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 20 million Yemenis in desperate need of humanitarian aid. It eclipses anything going on in Gaza. This conflict has also seen Houthis targeting international trade routes, particularly in the southern Red Sea and the strategically crucial Bab al-Mandab Strait, a vital corridor between Yemen and Africa. This strait is integral to global commerce, as it is a key passage for the Suez Canal shipping route, one of the most critical paths for the global seaborne transportation of commodities. This includes significant flow of crude oil and a fuel from the Gulf to the Mediterranean, as well as various other commodities destined for Asia, including Russian oil. Annually, about 10% of the world's trade passes through the Red Sea. Despite these disruptions, the global oil market has remained relatively unaffected. According to a statement from Goldman Sachs, the impact on crude and liquefied natural gas prices has been minimal. This resilience is partly due to the ability to redirect vessels around the troubled region. In response to the Houthi attacks, the United States has deployed three naval destroyers, the USS Kearney, USS Stethem, and the USS Mason to patrol the Bab al-Mandeb Strait, aiming to deter and respond to Houthi aggressions. Now, complicating the situation is that Iran has escalated its involvement by dispatching a warship to the Red Sea. This move by Tehran adds to the already volatile situation in the region. In a direct response to the growing tensions and the recent U.S.-Houthi confrontations, Maersk, a global leader in shipping services, has suspended its transit through the Red Sea, underscoring the increasing risks and uncertainty in this crucial maritime area. Now, this concludes part one of our three-part series. I hope you found this segment valuable. As I said in the beginning, I have a bias, and that is going to become even more evident in the next sections. Here's what you'll hear when we get to these next sections. In section two, Behind the Bloodshed, How Zionism and Jihadism Differ, will include the history and details of the October 7th attack, the motivations of Hamas and Israel, and a recount of my recent trip to those areas that were attacked in Israel. In the third section, we're going to talk about the echoes of war, jihadism and the American divide. We're going to try in that section to deal with the tough questions like proportionality, Israel's burden in the war, apartheid, colonization, and the two-state solution. And finally, a commentary or at least talk about what's happening here at home. I hope you liked this program, and if you did, push that subscribe button. We also appreciate your comments, and any time that we're wrong on the facts or you see something that we're wrong on, go ahead and put a source in that comment section. We love having your input. Thanks again. This is Paul Johnson.
And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils. It holds out the promise of more sacrifice instead of more security. The new frontier is here.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We'll preserve for our children this, the last best hope of man on earth, or we'll sentence them to take the last step into 1,000 years of darkness.